And this is quite an informal sort of talk, just about my own memories and autobiography and reflections on anthropology, history and memory. I have a large room at my home which is full of paper. This is filled with photographs, books, letters, other papers. So it is very appropriate to be giving this talk in a famous room of memories. Professor Fei Shao Tung and the famous School of Anthropology at Peking University. So this sort of room, which is bigger than this, but all the walls covered with papers, boxes and boxes of papers. This is two kinds and sets of papers. One are papers which my family has left to me. So my grandmother, my great-grandfather, and so on and so on. About 12 generations of my family have left papers which have come down finally to me from all over the British Empire, from India, from Burma, from China, from Jamaica, everywhere. All these papers and letters have come down to me. Also, I have many, many papers of my own. I have kept, since I was about 15 years old, I have kept all my papers, if possible. So all the letters to me, my Christmas cards, even my toys and other things, I have kept. I wonder how many of you keep papers. How many of you have got a lot of paper from your childhood or from your schools or from your early years? Please put your hands up if you have. Quite a few. How many of you keep diaries? A diary? Yes, that's good. It's a very good thing and very important, as you know, for an anthropologist to keep a diary. So I have a huge amount of paper, and I have now for 3 years been retired from my professorship at Cambridge. So I have time now to think about what to do with all this paper. I am going to give it to libraries and archives, museums, but I want to make sense of it now before I give it to the libraries. And in particular, I have certain questions in the back of my mind. One of them is, how did I come to be sitting in Peking University in front of Fei Shao Tung's books? In other words, how did I get to where I am now? And who am I? So this is the search behind much what we call autobiography, writing about yourself. I'm sure that Fei himself wrote autobiographical works, and most academics at some point write something about their own lives to try and understand themselves in time. The second question is to do with my family and its history. The English middle class, upper middle class, tend to keep a lot of paper and to have been doing interesting jobs, and my family has had a very interesting history. So I am trying to see the world through a particular family and all its ancestors. The third question concerns England and Britain. Much of my work has been about the strangeness of the English. When I gave this talk in Japan, I said that people who live in corners, this is a famous quotation, the people who live in corners always think themselves strange. So the English and the Japanese, who both live in corners of a big continent, think of themselves as strange, but I personally do think the English are quite odd and peculiar, and I have devoted quite a lot of my life and books to the peculiarity of the English. So by looking at myself and my family, I can see more deeply into the peculiarity of the English. And the final question concerns the nature of the British Empire. Now, many countries have had empires, the Spanish Empire, the Portuguese, and so on. But the British Empire seems to me, again, to be rather peculiar. It is peculiar for several reasons. One is that it was very long lasting, 200-300 years of a great empire. Secondly, it was the biggest empire in terms of geographical spread in history, about a quarter of the humankind. And thirdly, because it was felt different. It was started off quite peacefully as a trading empire, not as a conquest empire. And above all, it was held together by something peculiar, which I'll talk about a bit more later perhaps. It was held together by imagination. Now, some of you may have heard of the theory of Benedict Anderson, imagined communities, and his idea is that modern nationalism, nation-state, was constructed when people could no longer know everyone who they met. They started to imagine that they were Han, and therefore united to everyone they met, or whatever. And the British Empire was like Anderson's theory, but much larger. It was over the whole world. It was held together by very few people. It was run from England, which only had a few million people, and yet it was an empire of hundreds of millions. And it had very small armies and bureaucracies. So how were they able to hold together this huge empire? So that is my fourth question. And now I would like to talk to a little bit about how I want to approach this. Firstly, I'd like to talk about memory. Now, you may think, as I assume you are all social scientists, are you? Anthropologists, sociologists, or in the social sciences? Is that the case or not? Are some of you physicists or chemists? Or am I talking to social scientists?
Yes.
Mainly social scientists? Well, even if you're physicists, as I know one of you is, and one was, the importance of memory in your work is probably much greater than you realize. We are taught when we do our training to be students of anthropology or sociology or the social sciences, that what we deal with are facts, that what we do is we go off to Shangri-La or wherever we go, and we gather together facts, and then we organize the facts and write our PhD or thesis. This is an idea of the social sciences which we call very positivistic. It's really much more applicable in some ways to an old kind of archaeology, where you go out to somewhere and you start digging, and then you dig out some objects, and then you come and bring them back to your room and write them up, as it's called. So writing up is the stage after you've done your field work, and you organize them in an order and you try and link them together, and you have all these facts. Actually, although you do that, much more important probably is memory. Because what you do as an anthropologist or a historian is to have the experience, go out, do your field work, participant observation, and then you come back away from the field or away from the library, and then you use your memory. You are no longer there. You are reliving your experience a second time. So the field work is done in the mind, a second field work in the mind. And this is true of all kinds of work. I think it's even true of great physicists, Einstein and others. They don't actually write their work and do their work sitting in front of an experiment. They do their experiments, then they go away for a walk or a drink or a talk, and then they, from their memories, their memory pulls together all their thoughts. And great historians also work like that, from memory. So memory is terribly important. The trouble is that our memories are very bad, at least my memory is very bad. How, it would be very interesting, I talked to the Japanese students about this, to see how much they could remember clearly about their earlier lives. Now most of you are about 20 or 25 years old. How many of you can remember quite strongly when you were about 10 or 11 years old? In other words, if I asked you to write down your memories of when you were 10 or 11, would you be able to fill a book with it, or just a chapter with it, or just a few pages, do you think? Who could fill a book with their memories of when they were 10, 11, 12? How many could fill a chapter? Okay, a few. And most of you were like me. When I sat down to write my memories of when I was 11 or 12, I could write 20 pages, something like that, just a chapter. What happens as we get older is that we remember certain things very, very strongly, usually painful events or nice events. Everything else is just a blur. And also the memories are fragmented. There's a little memory here, little memory there, but you can't tell which came before the other or how they were linked or what was happening in between. So I will just give you one description of this process, or perhaps two quickly. One English writer wrote, "Early impressions are like glimpses through the window by night when lightning, when it's flashing with lightning, the flash leaps out without visible cause or warning, and the blackness lifts for a second, revealing the scene, the crisscross of the rods of rain, the trees shining with moisture." So it is with memory. My early blinks are exceedingly vivid, but they are separated, and though the passage of time does not dim them, as it dims the more fading impressions of later life, they do not form part of a continuous picture. It's the second quote I won't read, but it's the same point, that you have these flashes, disconnected flashes. And also our memory tends to distort hugely, in that from these flashes we pick up a picture of ourselves some time back, which is either tends to be more positive. We remember a period, a holiday, a friendship as wonderful. I remember my time at Oxford as an undergraduate. as just one long golden summer afternoon on a punt with my girlfriend. But when I came to read all my papers and write my book on my time at Oxford, I found that there were other things as well as golden summer afternoons with my girlfriend, like a huge amount of work, stress, worry, anxiety, frustration, etc. On the other hand, when I remembered my years between about 6 and 13, those 6 years, I remember them as very sad, and I was very miserable, and I never smiled, and I was unhappy because my parents were in India. I was born and brought up in India and sent home to England when I was 5. And I remember them as lonely years of separation from my parents, of being frightened in my schools. I went to English boarding schools. When I came to read the letters and accounts which I had kept, I found this wasn't true. I was much happier than I had remembered, according to the letters and other materials. So how does one overcome the problems of memory? Well, just briefly, there are two approaches. One is the one which you will use, which is when you do your anthropological and sociological fieldwork, you will collect lots of paper, diaries, letters to other people, maybe, or emails nowadays. Your Facebook will no doubt be full of useful photographs and memories, and photographs, and film maybe. And from that, you will try to add to your memory. And that will have two strong consequences. Firstly, it will give you fresh memories, because these notes of yours or photographs, you see a photograph and suddenly you remember all around the photograph, and you remember it's a strange experience with photograph and film, that you can remember not only what you've photographed, but that moment with who was standing beside you and behind you and so on. So you use the material you've collected to enrich it. Another problem is how unique is one's own memory? How much has one distorted it and seen things in a peculiar way, partly because of your own character, partly because of the effects of memory? And when I started writing my autobiography of my family, I was worried that what I was remembering of my early life, which I decided to start with the period between the ages, as I say, of 6 and 12, that this was going to be, I was misremembering, that I'd got it all wrong. Fortunately, very fortunately, just as I was starting this process and had written a first rough draft, I met another little boy who had been to my school with me. He'd not only been to what we call a preparatory school, that is a primary school, a boarding school, but he also had then gone on to my next school, my public school. And he became interested, and I had about 150 letters which I had written from my school to my parents in India, and their letters to me. And he started working on this independently and writing his own memories down. And then, fortunately, he found all of his letters and his brother's letters. His brother had died. His brother was my age. He was 1 year older. So we had three little boys looking at the same experience of going through a school between the age we went to the school at 8 and 13. And we found, when we joined together the three memories and compared them, there was very little contradiction or clash or difference between them. Each of us remembered a few extra things, but there was very little inaccuracy, it seemed, and very little difference in looking at our world. Now, the result of that, I thought I was going to write one chapter about my age between 8 and 13, as you would have done. But instead, the result of doing this was this book, and this book, and another book, which he wrote. So this is my home life, my life in Dorset in England. This is our joint school life, and he wrote another book like that. So we have over 1,200 pages about just 6 years of our lives. And I'll pass it round, you can have a look. The back you'll see all the I like to publish the evidence on which a book is based. So at the back are all the photographs and some of the letters and some of my drawings from my school essays. And the school reports were kept, and letters with drawings in them, and all the early letters, and all the school photos. So I'll pass it round and you can glance at it as you go along. And the other one, as I say, is about my home life. And there you see I kept all my toys. So I probably will give all my toys to, I'm afraid, to Tsinghua University. But maybe you will get one or two tiger's teeth over there, if you especially would like something to put over there. But these are all my school toys, which I still keep. And then my drawings and my letters home and so on and so on. So these are the sources for home life there. So, moving on to the problems which this kind of work creates. The first one is, and I'll go quite quickly through these, the first concerns what anthropologists after Clifford Geertz have sometimes called thick and thin description. Do any of you know these terms, thick and thin description? You do. Basically, anthropology's great strength is in giving a detailed micro account of a world different from ours. Professor Wang Mingming's excellent book on a southern city is full of detail, as are the works of great anthropologists. If you read the great generation of anthropologists, British structural functional anthropologists, their books on Africa or India or whatever, are full of very detailed descriptions of rituals, of kinship systems, and the importance is that detail, the thick, thick description. The problem is, of course, that and that kind of description is very important for the work I'm doing, because it's based on documents like letters, particularly letters, diaries, other documents, and they lose all their meaning if you summarize them. If you just give, say, and then there was a letter which talked about being sad at school, that means nothing. You have to give the letter, you have to quote a serious amount of original material. But as any of you who've done a PhD or are doing a PhD know, after a while, when you read these, the reader, unless they're very sympathetic and got a lot of time and interest, can get very bored with reading this. Xiao Xiao is nodding her head strongly. This is a problem that she and others have faced. So how do you somehow produce enough of the detail, but not too much? Well, there are several problems coming from that. One is how you publish, make this material available. And here the problem is that if, as I hope some of you will, when you've written your thesis, you want to publish it, if you try and publish it in a hardback book like these, nowadays, certainly in the West, and I imagine increasingly in China, publishers, academic publishers and others, will say, well, we can't publish it. We can't find enough people. We've got to have at least 500 or 1,000 people who we know will buy this. And yet it is a very detailed micro account of a very small place or a set of events. And the audience isn't there. We can't afford it. So there was a time when anthropology was so exotic that you could expect quite a large audience to read about strange behavior on a Pacific island far away, Malinowski and so on. Now it's not so strange and exotic, and therefore publishers won't publish anthropology. Also, the readers of your book are going to be scattered around, spread around the world. They won't all be able to go to a bookshop and see the book in the window or read a review in a learned journal. So when I wrote this book, these books, and started this, I was faced with the problem of who would publish this. And of course, no one would. If I had gone to a normal publisher and said I had written 1,200 pages with lots of illustrations about my boyhood between 6 and 12, they would have said, well, thank you very much, Alan, but come and have a drink and I'll explain why we can't publish it. What has happened, though, of course, is internet publishing. Can you go through a bit? Or can you hear out there?
Yes.
Yeah. So what I did with these is that you can now publish on demand or electronically without any cost in at the front. There's no upfront cost. And you can put it up, this has been put up on Amazon and electronic websites, or you can use the new Apple iBook application or whatever. And so it can reach a wide audience, and there is no really, it doesn't matter if it's 100 people read it, or 20 people read it, or 1,000 people. So electronic publication is making it possible in the same way as film making. I have, if you're interested in my work, then I would suggest you Google my name, Alan McFarlane, and you come to my website. Unfortunately, I have about 1,000 films on YouTube. Can any of you get onto YouTube? Yeah? Do you know any ways? No? Completely blocked, is it? Okay. Well, because of this, I have a student who is setting up my website in China, and so she is going to put all my films, 1,000 films from YouTube, onto Xinhua.com or something like that. It's now possible to publish films. It doesn't cost anything, and you can make them freely available. And the same with books. So that is one partial solution to this problem. The second partial solution is and this is what all PhD and other theses writers and writers in general have to do, which is to change the level. This is something I've discussed many times with Xiao Xiao and others, that a reader will be happy if you have some thick description, but you also have to have some thin description. You have to have an argument and then take down into the evidence and then come up out of the evidence. And more generally, you have to do this as a way of studying any topic. There are two tendencies in academic life. One is to become, as you go on with your work, to become more and more interested in the detail and to lose sight of the question. And this tends to happen with many of my academic friends. You know, you ask them what they have been doing for the last 5 or 10 years, and you realize that they have completely forgotten that they are meant to be pursuing some interesting larger hypothesis. They've become obsessed with some very minor thing, which really doesn't matter very much. I mean, it's interesting. And that's what sometimes one academic friend of, or at least not friend, but a colleague of mine described as truffle hunting. Do any of you know what truffle hunting is? Truffles are like mushrooms. They're very, very, very valuable mushrooms. And in France particularly, you use, I think, pigs maybe. You take your pig along, you walk along behind it, and when it goes and starts digging away, then you know you might have one of these very valuable truffles. And some historians and anthropologists are truffle hunters. They go along like this and then dig away and never look up. The person who made this criticism said that he was like a parachutist. He was right up there and up in the sky, and then he would come down and look at a problem and then go back up. And the great French social historian Marc Bloch said that this is what historians must do. They mustn't fall into the trap of becoming just in love with the micro, the detail, the truffles. But equally dangerous is to become just so general, so vague. And a number of historians and some social scientists become like that, particularly if they are on television. Some of the television academics, they get further and further and further away, and they start just generalizing without any basis of evidence. Now, the danger of truffle hunting or getting lost in the detail is one that is particularly dangerous for people like myself who have retired. Because when you are teaching, when you are lecturing, when you have younger people like yourselves, then you constantly have to deal with larger questions. They wouldn't be interested in the detailed stuff you're doing. So you have to make your questions broader and lecture and explain to a wider audience. But when you retire, you don't have that obligation. So it is a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to younger people and to have your views and feedback and to give lectures. That's very important. But of course, the internet now has also changed the situation, because I now work collaboratively with people in all different parts of the world. And so you are kept in contact with wider questions in that way. The next problem is one which is a familiar one for social scientists and particularly anthropologists. And this is the problem of the over-familiarity of everyday life, or the banality or the boringness of everyday life. It seems appropriate in this setting to quote Confucius, it would not have been a fish that discovered water, or a bird that discovered air. You know this quotation? It would not be, have been a fish that discovered water, or a bird that discovered air.
Okay.
So basically, if it's all around us, we cannot see it. So when you were writing about your own experience and your own childhood, or when many of you, how many of you hope to or are working on subjects within China? In other words, how many of you are intending to go outside Han, China? One of you, you're going outside, are you?
I'm working on the Tibetans.
Tibetans, yes. That's probably sufficiently far. Or ethnic minority groups also. But if you're studying your own culture, living in your own culture, studying your own life, living in your own life, it's very difficult to see it. It seems so obvious. And even if you see it, you feel it's not worth writing down or telling other people about. So when I started writing these books, I thought, well, who possibly could be interested in what a little boy thought 50 years ago? Surely this is very boring. Every little boy thought the same things, and no one wants to know. So you have to, in a sense, distance yourself. And there are various ways of doing this. The two main ways of doing it are to distance yourself in time. So to let events pass, and then the past becomes interesting. So the fact I'm writing about 50 years ago, when in many ways this was the generation of just the beginning of the, for example, the pop scene, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, and so on, were just starting. So it was a different world. The medical world was different, the transport world, the technology. So it feels a foreign country, a different world. And that gives it a specialness and makes me want to record it. The other is to distance yourself spatially. What and why anthropology contributes so much to our thought is because most anthropologists have gone to very different cultures, and they've been shocked and surprised and wanted to write down about the differences. But also, ideally, when they go there, they look back on their own culture and they see that as shocking and surprising. Now, I worked first in England, and I couldn't really see England because I was in England and I'd been educated there. I then went to the Nepal Himalayas, Mount Annapurna, and I have worked for 40 years in the Himalayas, in a village there. I then went to Japan, have worked for 20 years in Japan, and I then came with Chow Chow the first time to China, and have been working here for on and off for 10 years. And each time you get a shock of surprise when you go to the other culture, and you also see your own culture with surprise. So I've looked back and thought, how strange is England? I mean, the English always think they are normal. We are normal, the rest of you are very strange. But in fact, it's the other way around. You are fairly normal, though the Chinese are very different, of course, from everyone else. But looking back on my own civilization, England, in many, many ways, its kinship system, its language, its political system, its school system, everything is very, very odd, unlike anywhere else in the world. Until 150 years ago, it was just this tiny little island with a strange legal system or culture. So basically, you have to distance yourself. And in particular, what I'm working on and is strange, and I would very much value any comments on this, is the strange educational system of the English. This is why these books are about English education. Our educational system was based on, for 500 years, has been based on the idea of destroying the family. I hope that will shock you. The idea is that all societies, you're born and brought up with your parents as a young child, and you tend in China, Japan, everywhere else in the world, you stay with your parents. Even in France, you will go off to school, you'll have your lessons to improve your mind, but your family is the center of your heart and where you learn your ethical system, where everything is taught to you except things of the mind. And that's true all over Europe, it's true in India, it's true in China, it's true in Japan. England developed this extraordinary system whereby at the age of 6, 7, 8, you were sent away from your home to strangers, not to your kin, not to your cousins or your uncles or anything like that, to complete strangers. If you were very poor, you would go off as a servant. You would work for some master. If you were slightly richer, you would go as an apprentice. You would be learning a skill with some master. If you were richer, you would go to a school, a boarding school, a grammar school. If you were very rich, you would go and live in the household of a lord or aristocrat. But in all these cases, you would leave home 6, 7, 8, live in a stranger's house, and never come home. I mean, obviously you'd come home for holidays, but you would never rejoin your home. And what this does is it creates the modern world. It creates capitalism and it creates individualism, the two main pillars of modernity in the West. Because, as Max Weber pointed out, the definition of capitalism is when you split the social unit from the economic unit. You create a market capitalist society in which you sell your labor in the market, and the social unit, which is the household, is separate from that. So the household is no longer the unit of production and consumption. This destroys peasant civilizations, the sort of thing that Bechartan is describing. Because by taking the children out of the social unit and putting them in the market, because they become free individuals in a market society, they then become free actors in the capitalist world. And they become individuals. They are no longer subordinate to their parents. They are no longer entitled to all that their parents have. The basic unit in all civilization has been the family, from whom you could expect to inherit wealth, your name, who would arrange your marriage, and everything. In our case, we get split away. It's as powerful as a nuclear explosion. It's a fission, it's a breaking like this, and it has generated modernity. Without this, you wouldn't be sitting here. The modern world would not have occurred if the British had not created this educational system which split the atom of the family and generated a world of individuals and capitalist ethics. Now, I never really understood any of this until I went away, because I was brought up in the system. I assumed for 20 years of my life that everyone sent their children away, that everyone made them into lonely individuals, that everyone married because they fell in love, which is part of this pattern, because if you split like this, then you are left alone and as half a person, because your parents, you were like this with your parents, and then you've been separated, your parents and family are there, they no longer are the important emotional force in your life because they have their relationship to each other, that which is most important. So you split apart and then you are alone and only half a person. And our romantic love system is because we are lonely individuals. The famous line in John Donne's poem, when love so interanimates, that interanimates means joined together, two souls, it defects of loneliness control. Our problem is loneliness, the lonely crowd that David Huseman talked about. So, when we fall in love, we join and are made whole again. And that is the great bond in our society. I mean, there are lots of divorces, people break up again, but for a moment, or hopefully, they think they have found what we call their soulmate. They become one mind and one body. Now, that educational system, that romantic love system, that family system, is totally peculiar. It's not to be found anywhere else in the world, except England and to a certain extent in Holland and Scandinavia. But I didn't realize it when I went through it myself. The next problem that I want to mention, which I don't know how many of you will be affected by this, is what someone called Irving Goffman called the problems of the backstage and the front stage. Do some of you know this theory? Which is basically that we live our life on a public stage, here am I, and so on. But I have come from a private world. So if I suddenly got out my razor, which I was using this morning, and started shaving myself, you would all be probably a little embarrassed wondering what I was doing when I brushed my teeth and behaved in the private way I do in front of you, because this is public life. Now, the aim of good social science, as Goffman points out, is to go backstage, not to see the representations of the public life and not to accept that as the final thing. We want to know why people behave as they do, and in order to do that you need to go behind the stage. This is a metaphor from a play. And that's what anthropologists do. They dig around, and historians as well. The problem is, of course, that you discover too much. You discover many private things about private lives. And then you get the problem of one of the big problems of anthropology. How much do you reveal? Now, this is, I don't know how many of you have thought about this question, but in anthropology there are some protective devices. Early on, there was the protection of the fact that if you wrote a book in anthropology about some peasant society, often they were illiterate and they would never come to read your book anyway. So you could describe it and so on, and there was no problem that their lives would be affected by it. More recently, most societies may get hold of your book. But the anthropologist has two advantages. One is that they write their account, so they can decide which bits they want to include or leave out, where they summarize just someone's arguments without giving any indication of who made these arguments. And in extreme cases, they can change the names. You just give another name. The problem with the sort of work that I'm doing with my friend Jamie is that it loses all its meaning if you start leaving out too much. And it loses its meaning if you change all the names. It's meant to be a historical account. But it is just on that point where people who you're describing are still alive and could still be affected. To give you an example, when I started writing my Oxford undergraduate book, I was 18, and I had my first love affair. Fell in love with a girl, and for 6 months we wrote letters to each other. I then had another later after that, and we'd broken up, and I had a second love affair which went on for a year. These were really, as I've mentioned with romantic, very intense. This is the first time I and these girls had opened up themselves to another person since childhood. The relationship they'd had with their parents, their mothers, and so on, had been really unspoken. But now they were putting down onto paper their real, true feelings in an intense relationship. And I had something like 200 letters from these two girls. And as I started to work, I tried to find them on the internet, and I found both of them. And one of them was very happy that I should do this, and she had a very good memory, and she said that she would be very happy to read anything and comment on it. The other one wrote back saying she didn't really want to remember all this. You know, she's married, she's got a new life. She doesn't want to go back into all that. Maybe nervous what her husband might say. But she had kept all my letters carefully, organized them into date, and she sent them to me. So she sent me 92 letters, which I'd written to her. So I had something like 300 letters, very intimate love letters between a man and a woman, or a young man and a young woman. What to do with this? Do I change their names? Do I leave out? I mean, there's nothing awful in them, but, you know, they're very open. So that's the sort of problem. But there are other things which one has to decide what one's going to do with. So these are questions which you will probably have to face yourself, the questions of privacy and truth. And the last difficulty is a very general one, which I don't know whether you thought about. Anthropology was a very interesting. I'm giving the Huxley Memorial Lecture at the Royal Anthropological Institute in the autumn. This is the top lecture in Britain in anthropology, and I will be talking about this. So you could be able to read it later on. But anthropology was born in a curious period in Britain, and it really was largely, in some ways, a British invention, anthropology. There were some Americans, but about the same time, but Anglo-American invention. And of course, the great Chinese anthropologists were tended to be trained in Britain. Was also trained there. Now, it was born in a strange period, at the height of the imperial expansion of Britain, Victorian England, but also in a society which was by far the most modern, advanced society in the world. The first industrial revolution, the first scientific revolution had occurred there. And you had a new kind of civilization on this earth, a modern society. The anthropologists went from this modern society, which, above all, had a curious feature to it. And I'll see if I can explain this very quickly. My definition of modernity, and if you're interested in this, I gave 17 lectures at Tsinghua last year, the Wang Guwei lectures, on the invention of the modern world. They're all on my website. You can see them. The films are there, and also the texts. If you go to the fortnightly review, which you'll see easily, I'm publishing them on that, and they're going to be published in Chinese. But basically, the theme was what we mean by modernity, what I mean by modernity, is taking Max Weber's idea of the separation of the economic and the social, and extending this to the separation of the economic, social, the ideological, and the political. These are the four spheres or areas of social of our worlds: power, wealth, sentiment, social sentiment, and belief. These are the four things that human beings do, and they are the institutional spheres. Modernity consists of disembedding, as Polanyi called it, separating out, separating the social from the economic and the political from the religious, until they are all separate, and the only thing that unites them is the individual. So my wife is now going to change
the film.
So the modern world consists of separating these, and then a dynamic tension. The West is filled with contradictions and tension between the demands of our families, our God, our state, and our economy. If any of them become too powerful, then the system collapses and we get an absolutist world. But we try to keep them apart, as with our separation of religion and politics, apart as in our separation of politics and law, and apart. So that, just to give you an example, if an English person was selling their house, an economic transaction, and their brother, or sister, or cousin said, "I would like to buy your house. Can I have 25% off?" You'd say, "Sorry, I mean, a house is a house. I have to raise the money. We can't let emotion and sentiment and so on." Or, to take another example, in politics, if you start trying to influence politics with money too directly, we call this corruption. In fact, corruption is often the word that is used when you try and mix things together. If you try and get your children into a good position through family influence, we call that corruption, because you're mixing the economy with the family. So basically, we have separated our worlds, and that is what I call the modern world. And that is the world of America and England. It's not yet the world of China, because you have a dominant ideology, and you haven't separated out fully, and your law is very weak, and so you are still enmeshed somewhat. But the anthropologists who went from Britain were coming from a modern world, and they went to somewhere famously, like New Guinea, or the Amazon Basin, or African tribes, where the absolute central characteristic was complete embedding. A tribe is, by definition, doesn't have an economy, it doesn't have a state, doesn't have writing. It is determined, if anything, by the family system. And so they had to try and understand a world which was absolutely the other extreme from their own experience of life. So they had to make a huge mental effort to do that. But sometimes they succeeded, and they came back and gave us their famous accounts of these worlds. Now, at least the anthropologists knew that they were going to places which were all joined together, holistic societies, as we call them. The difficulty of studying my own childhood is the difficulty of being a participant observer, which is the definition of anthropology, of my own life at a time when I lived in a pre-modern society, that is, childhood. How I think of childhood in my own case is really as moving through the famous evolution of stages that anthropologists used to teach. I don't know whether you still teach this at all, but when I taught first year anthropologists, I would say there are four kinds of human society. There are hunter-gatherers who live for the present, who don't accumulate wealth, who live in small groups, who hunt and forage around the place. That was what I was like as a small child. Not much memory, no writing, not much hierarchy, just a hunter-gatherer in my Indian infancy when I was a little child. I then went to my first school, my preparatory boarding school, and I became like a tribal person. Lots of customs, lots of myths, lots of rituals, lots of group behavior. So I was a little tribesman. I then went to my public school, and I immediately found the state and civilization. In other words, there were hierarchies, social hierarchies, there were rules, there was writing. It was like a peasant society for 5 years. I then went to university, and the purpose of university was to turn me into a modern human being. In other words, to teach me to balance the calls and demands. I became even less interested in my family. I became aware of the economy, I became aware of my political obligations, my religion shrank, and things became balanced and modern. So I emerged from university, hopefully modern. Now, the difficulty of writing about this is that I'm writing about myself going through the stages of civilization. And I'm finding it very difficult mentally to think myself back into a time when I was non-modern, when I was just... Because this is, in a way, what interests me most. How do we construct a modern person? How do we make ourselves modern? And what do we lose when that happens? Because I've always been interested in childhood and in children's worlds. I film a lot about children. I've always been interested in children's books. And at the time, of course, I was reading all these books. Now, the tragedy of the modern world is this separation, the losing of coherence, the contradictions. And it is no wonder, I think, that the greatest writers on childhood are English. If you think of the great children's writers, at least we tend to think, I mean, there are fairy stories from all countries, but in terms of getting inside childhood worlds as adults, from Lewis Carroll, the Alice books, Pooh Bear, right up to Harry Potter and C.S. Lewis and so on, nearly all the great children's writers in the world are English or Scottish. And this is because they look back and with wonder and amazement and want to relive, re-enter that world which they have lost. Likewise, the greatest poets of childhood, like William Wordsworth or William Blake, are English, because again, they have experienced this pain of the separation and growing up to be modern. So my autobiography, of which you've seen a little bit when I've talked, is an attempt to explain more for you than for the English friends. I'm writing for my Chinese friends, for my Japanese friends, to try and explain the peculiar predicament of being modern. Because this will be something you may want to discuss. I don't know how modern you are. I suspect you are still half and half. Now, of course, there is a famous book by Bruno Latour called We Have Never Been Modern. And he is right that, in a sense, modernity is impossible because it's a contradiction of reality. In reality, we are glued to our parents, we are glued to God, and so on. We can't separate, and as he says, this creates all sorts of monsters in our society. But the English pretend to be modern. They imagine they're modern. They try and fight to be modern. And this is interesting in itself. And you in China, and this is why China is so fascinating for us, you are going through something which may take you towards modernity. But I suspect not. I suspect you are going to, as with Japan, go in a new direction and lead us in the West back from modernity to something else.